sexual relationships were free and open, and there was no need for oppression because there was no concept of property rights, and there was no concept of needing a direct line of descendants in order to pass down property. So that is one kernel of a bygone era that we're hoping to rekindle. You can't rekindle a kernel. One spark from a bygone era that we're hoping to rekindle into, you know, something in the future to help build a socialist society. I didn't carry that metaphor to fruition. To help burn down, create a socialist forest fire of freedom. Hello, and welcome to the Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
I'm Kevin.
I'm Jason.
And I'm Jenny.
And today we are talking about sexual liberation under 20th century socialism and what lessons we can draw from it looking forward at the society that we would like to build in the future.
So today we're talking about an era in which women knew what orgasms were. Let's go.
Actually, that's a pretty good one, because that was one of the most striking things about the research that went into why women had better sex under socialism. Like the poll that said that 80% of women in the German Democratic Republic always experienced orgasm versus in the Federal Republic only 50%. I mean, that's incredibly striking. To me, that's the argument. That's a slam dunk right there.
Well, compared to 84% of FRG men and a mere 46% of FRG women. So that's what strikes me the most, actually, is like...
Oh, no. That was the sexual satisfaction survey.
Like, yeah.
They felt as though they were happy with their most recent sexual trysts, right? 86% of men were happy with it, and only like 46% of women were happy?
84% of men versus 46% of women, which like sounds like now.
I was going to say that sounds pretty similar to the terrible society that I live in.
Yeah, well, it is the terrible society you live in because it's capitalism, right?
But
we're really, really doing a good job of just like weaving in that, you know, revolutionary pessimism now.
Yeah. I was politically raised to think that there was these sort of mirror societies. In a lot of ways, I agree with this, right? That there's these twin societies that were like exploitative and alienating in very similar ways. But what the stuff that we read about this really made me think of is how much of an effort these societies seemed to have tried to make to actually apply a lot of socialist theory about achieving parity between peoples, specifically like gender parity and sexual relations.
I was struck by the fact that the Eastern Bloc countries, not all of them, obviously, because I guess Romania and Albania are excluded from this conversation in that they were just as reactionary, if not more so, than the Western countries were when it came to issues of women's sexual liberation or just women's equality in general.
Mm-hmm.
These Eastern Bloc countries, these totalitarian countries, right, supposedly... I take issue with the idea that they were totalitarian states. Some states were more totalitarian than others, but I would say that like maybe Romania, Albania, and to a certain extent the Soviet Union under Stalin were totalitarian. You know, I don't know. That's a conversation for another time, I think.
I think she characterized them as authoritarian and not necessarily totalitarian.
Absolutely. I don't take issue with that at all. They're definitely authoritarian. But what I was trying to say was that these authoritarian states went miles and miles further in achieving the goals of bourgeois liberalism when it comes to women's emancipation, further than even our society now has. Like, I think that we are now reaching the levels of representation in government that East Germany had in the 80s, you know?
I mean, we might still be pretty far behind that. There's a comment about totalitarianism that I want to make. Which is that...
Go for it.
I think it's a useful term only if we acknowledge first that the modern state is totalitarian. And society, class society in the modern world is totalitarian. There are very relative degrees of it, right? But like, we live in a totalitarian society where literally every aspect of our life is completely subordinate to the rule of the commodity. Typically, we only understand that to mean subordinate to the rule of like a particular ideology, but... if we think about what society is and how control is meant, how control works. I'm talking about degrees of totalitarian control.
Totalitarianism is a concept that was invented by Mussolini to describe fascism, which, by the definition of totalitarianism, Italian fascism was not.
Right, like not even close.
You know? Maybe Nazi Germany comes close. Stalin's Russia comes close. The DPRK definitely seems like it would be pretty close.
Yeah. You know? I guess, okay, so the thing that's interesting about these studies, about relative degrees of parity and autonomy for cross-genders in the Eastern Bloc, Warsaw Pact states, is that the underlying sort of material argument is rooted in, even in as much as it's somewhat flawed, it's rooted in, you know, socialist theory, like you were saying before, that goes back to its very beginnings, right? Where, mm-hmm. like, the absence of competitive mechanisms in society and the absence of fear of, like, starvation, you know, means, like, literally means an absence relative absence of fear of divorce, right? Like, that, you know, going all the way back to the origins of the socialist movement, you know, so socialist writers, thinkers, fighters have always posited that, like, so long as the household is a place of compulsion where, you know, like, all of the relations of class society are reproduced in the household. You know, what did Engels refer to this as the world historic defeat of women? And, you know, certainly the Warsaw Pact countries leave lots to be desired in the realm of, like, freedom. But this one's not, right? It's like, if you have a, if you're guaranteed a job and housing, you don't have to be stuck with a terrible husband. So just like right on the face of it, like the minimum demands of even the bourgeois feminist movement, they appear to have been achieved by what we call Stalinist society.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's also important to emphasize the fact that of the nature of the impact that this has society wide when it's not confined to an individual or a group of individuals, or maybe you could say a class of individuals that are sort of liberated from this being bound to the other sex. But it's rather the entirety of society that experiences this liberation, because there is a set of cultural expectations and norms that grow out of the economic conditions that underlie them, right? So there's an important impact on the way that people just generally operate in society and expect others to operate. It changes everything whenever it's the entirety of everyone rather than it just being a particular individual. It really, like,
right,
subverts the entire social relationship.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, I have this book I couldn't find. I was trying to find it, but I guess I packed it. But it's called, like, Bolshevik Visions. That's about the Cultural Revolution in the 1920s in Russia. Early Bolshevik attitudes toward sexual liberation and gender relations, you know, and it's all really clear that they tried to codify immediately, you know, into law this notion that, like, the sexual revolution is part and parcel to the socialist construction, that these things happen simultaneously, not, like, as a result of the other. But what I really liked was that mm-hmm. she acknowledges, and I think in a way that a lot of the left, at least from whence we come, acknowledges how much of that's aspirational rather than actual, right? That, like, Russian society in the 1920s is, you know, let's say, materially bereft of what's necessary to actually, like, put into practice a lot of the things which were actually written into law. You know, that, like, you know, women achieve legal equality. And in a lot of ways, you know, you see them, like, represented in the state. And you see, like, deep exploration into teaching, you know, party cadres the sort of theory of the past of people like Babel and Engels, and people like Kollontai, you know, being pushed way up at the forefront of the state. But it's also, like, it's all highly aspirational and falls really short of those promises kind of throughout the whole thing. And even in spite of that, they're still better off than women anywhere else in the world at that time.
One of the things I thought was interesting, too, is how they underscore a point that was made by our friend Stephen in the interview that we did with him. And that was that the Bolsheviks really didn't really pay much attention to any sort of codification of their laws. So they just came up with them as they needed to. So that there was a lot of pushback by some of the radical left portions of the Bolsheviks when laws were being codified to give women rights and to you know, liberalize divorce and make abortion legal, there was a lot of pushback. It's like, why are we making these laws? We don't need laws. We're going to be communist any day now, you know? We're going to have full communism any day now. We're not going to need these laws. And then the argument by the jurists was like, you know, these are transitionary laws. Yeah, of course. Yeah, we acknowledge that they're going to go away soon. And it really illustrates this just like unbridled optimism that existed during the revolution. And it just sort of makes the what actually happened that much more bitter. I think that the Bolsheviks realized that when they were enacting these laws that they needed something more than the liberation of Russian society in order for them to be successful, because they didn't have the resources nor the consciousness at the time for them to stick. They were imposing radical Bolshevik ideas of sex and gender and liberation on a country that was like literally barely out of the feudal system. And so not linking up with the European revolutions and not getting that sort of, not having that momentum carry forward sort of cut the project short.
Right. It's actually like the legal enshrining of certain rights, even though many of them are actually rolled back. That is the real legacy. You know, the society that collapses in 1991, you know, they already had McDonald's before the Soviet Union goes away, right? Like, Kosygin is pretty famous as a premier for having ushered in a period of like market liberalization as early as the late 60s. You know, piece by piece, this is a society that's moving toward its collapse and restructuring in the neoliberal world order. But it takes all the way until then to undo the codification of socialist law about the protection of women's and advancement of women's rights. You know, like it, even though it's like chiseled away and then brought back and whatever, that it takes the complete destruction of the whole society, even in its most degenerate form, before, at least according to the arguments made by people like Godsey, it takes all the way up until then for that legacy to be undone. And I think that says something enduring about the theory itself, about the sort of the underlying material basis of society is, you know, it's ultimately that's what determines our lives rather than our like individual preferences and practices on, you know, we can try to live freer lives, right? But the real degree of freedom is measured in, you know, what society allows or whatever.
So I think it's, we might as well just talk a little bit about the things that were accomplished by the Bolsheviks, or the things they tried to accomplish. So when the Bolsheviks came to power, they immediately set about legalizing homosexuality, liberalizing divorce laws. Now men and women could get a divorce for any reason. They took the institution of marriage away from the church, and they placed it under the auspices of the state. They gave illegitimate children equal rights, which, you know, it's kind of crazy to think about the fact that they didn't have them. But yes, it was a monarchist society fresh out of feudalism. The serfs had only been freed for about like 60 years, I believe, at the time. The serfs were emancipated right around the same time the slaves were emancipated in the United States.
I think actually it was like 2 or 3 years before. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Russian czars were more enlightened than the American planter class.
So abortion was made legal. There were welfare programs set up for women, and mothers, children. There was a women's department set up, which had the specific goal of educating women and welcoming them into their new place as leaders of the revolution and as Bolshevik women. Like Alexander Kollontai was provided with a portfolio to be able to accomplish these things. And these women's department that she headed, they had a train and priority access to the rails and to resources to be able to travel around during the Civil War and set up satellites of their women's department to be able to help with the Bolshevization of women.
That says it all right there. Like,
it really does.
You know, when you have like liberal feminist figures today and politicians talk about like keeping things within the realm of the possible, it's like these people were fighting the world's most vicious war and also like setting up, you know, communal kitchens so that women could feel the slightest bit freer, even as their, you know, armies fighting pitch battles all around. That's the level of commitment it takes to get an inch. You know, we were talking about reforms earlier.
And really in the 1920s, after the devastation of the First World War and after the devastation of the Civil War and the war against the 14 invading armies that tried to topple the Bolsheviks and the isolation of the Bolshevik Revolution, the things started to go south. And they started to go south before Stalin, even. Mm-hmm. And the Bolsheviks sort of acknowledged that they didn't have the money to carry the programs to fruition and started cutting back on them. Because I think that, and I don't think that, I know that, they assumed that worldwide revolution was going to break out. They assumed that Germany was going to go next, and that would set off a chain reaction throughout Europe, and they would be able to link up with the West and have a redistribution of resources to be able to help the ailing and backward Russian economy. And once that didn't happen, the cold, hard reality of trying to hold out until something else could happen set in. And that's when things started to go south for the women's movement. And what Stalin Stalin represents the realization of the failure of the Russian Revolution more than anything else. And he sort of brings back all of the old, not all of the, he doesn't bring back sort of old Russian morality so much as just ushers in a sort of petty bourgeois morality.
Yeah, I was going to say that's what Godsey refers to, Stalin's petty bourgeois morality, and she contrasts it to like Bolshevik sexual radicalism.
I think she's quoting Ernst Mandel
on
that.
But also what I think is most notable about Christine Godsey's book is that, you know, she doesn't just paint the picture that like, well, here are all of these advancements, here's all of this progress, and here's Stalin's reversal of it all. I really do love and appreciate that she still examines what life looked like for women under state socialism. And while not being an apologist for, you know, any of the reversals that did happen, and while we can't deny any of that, I feel like it's a pretty honest examination of, what life really was like.
I read a couple of other articles from the ISR and watched a video from one of the socialism conferences talking about the gains of the Bolsheviks. And the picture that was painted in those, and you know, I'm very familiar with this narrative, was that the Bolsheviks made everything better. And then, you know, Stalin shows up apropos of nothing and shuts it all down.
Well, you know,
and I'm not,
because he was a bad dude.
I'm not a defender of Stalin by any means.
He emerged from the mists of time and just sort of like took over.
I mean, that was an exaggeration on my part. It wasn't apropos of nothing, but I think that my experience in the past had always been whenever you talk about this sort of thing, it only matters that you hit the high points of what the Bolsheviks did right and the low points of what Stalin did wrong. And that there's not a lot of nuance in talking about what happened and in talking about how Stalin was a sort of unfortunately natural result of the degeneration and collapse of the Bolshevik Revolution, and that there was a trajectory that was set 10 years before Stalin took power.
Yeah.
And that, like, it's like Victor Serge said, the germ of Stalinism was in Bolshevism the entire time, and it just needed the proper incubation to grow into what it was. But what I was going to say is that, like, okay, one of the things that we never talked about was how these programs that were put into place without the resources that were needed to undergird them resulted in a disastrous situation. Lack of resources and lack of follow-through. Because the programs were set into place, the revolution degenerated, and they were not able to be pushed forward. It gave Stalin the excuses that he needed to be able to roll everything back.
Right.
If indeed that's what Stalin was doing. Who knows? You know, I think Stalin, first and foremost, was a ruthless pragmatist. He would have allowed women's liberation and whatever else if it gave him a consolidation of power, I think. But, you know, that's beside the point.
Well, I think... I think that's right. But I think Gotzi even... If I'm reading her correctly, I think she makes an even maybe a more nuanced point than even that about some of the failures of the early Bolsheviks, which were not uniformly simply for lack of sufficient resources or follow through, but were made in good faith, but, you know, didn't work. Like, she presents Kollontai's attempts at removal of love and marriage from the church and putting it in the hands of a civil relationship and that sort of thing. Some of the failures were due to men sort of skipping town and not being able to, and there not being enough resources to track them down and force them to pay child support and that yeah. sort of thing. But I think largely the point that she makes is that Kollontai's attempt was well-intentioned, but perhaps a bit utopian, that there needed to be more uprooting of the economic basis on which the old patriarchal sexual order,
the muck of ages,
for the muck of ages to sort of like fall off before you're able to institute this sort of utopian hippie, you know, free love.
Look at the way that even Kevin refers to the communist horizon as utopian hippie free love paradigm.
Well, that's another point she makes in the book.
Kollontai was perhaps the first hippie.
Well, Kollontai was actually one of the things that she, the points that she makes is that Kollontai was not for free love. Kollontai was didn't believe in polyamory. She didn't actually even like defend sex for pleasure. Interestingly enough, she thought that sex was something that you did with that lovers that had deep feelings for one another did, and that it should be pleasurable for them, and they should have the freedom for that blossom under a new socialist society. She was actually kind of prudish by our standards, and so was Lenin.
Even prudish by the standards of like American radicals in Greenwich Village at the same time, right?
Yeah, that's probably true.
Right. Yeah, actually, yeah, even. As compared to like Inessa Armand and some of the other more radical Bolshevik feminists, you know.
Right, or people like Nadezhda Krupskaya, who was mostly just remembered now as Lenin's wife, but was actually like a sexual pioneer, you know, more so than Kollontai, at least in terms of like everyday life, you know, along with Inessa Armand.
And Trotsky, for that matter, yeah. too, who apparently couldn't keep it in his damn pants.
It's Same. A proud tradition.
Yep.
Trotsky with the Lenin, relatable
Lenin
content.
Was a grouchy prude. You remember that there's one letter, and was it to Clara Zetkin?
Argues about with being the, an incel?
Argues about the necessity for discipline in love, as well as in revolution, because, you know, being...
So Volcel?
Yeah, I mean... Volcel. No. Just discipline. He just didn't think it was a good idea to go around screwing everybody. That was his argument. You know?
What's funny about that is I think it's in a Lunacharsky book. I forget the term, but it's like I forget what it's called, but it's about, you know, reminiscences of Lenin or something. And one of the things that he talks about is Lenin being somewhat exasperated by the like sex obsession of young communists. But like this one of the every Young Communist League meeting was always, that always came up was the topic of sexual relations. And it just kind of shows this interesting generational gap between, you know, the people who built toward the revolution and then the people who actually got to like come of age in the revolution. The idea of what free love meant or what sexual freedom meant, you know, for somebody like Kollontai, it means, you know, what if like your husband couldn't beat you and you also could just have a divorce and have another lover later if you wanted to. And then for young communists,
she was a serial monogamist.
Yeah. But then for young communists, you know, in the 1920s, their version of sexual liberation looks a lot more like what we now call polyamory, you know, and then it goes away, right? It goes away. In the 1930s, at least by the late thirties, you don't, that stuff's referred to as like bourgeois degeneracy. So the point of all this is like, you know,
is that, Alexander Kollontai was not woke, so she's
Kollontai's canceled. No, but also that, you know, social construction, society, it's organic, right? And it doesn't just, like, go this way or it goes back and forth. And that you could actually track the relative health of the socialist project in Russia by, you know, how people's attitudes about sexuality and family and gender shift back and forth.
It's too bad our listeners can't see your visual aid.
Oh, my holding my pen and going up and down. So sometimes it was good.
Yeah, shifting.
And sometimes it was not good. Sometimes. No, I actually...
You speak with your hands a lot, and it's funny when you do it while we're recording the podcast.
Nobody will ever know. There was a period in time where me and another comrade had proposed a talk for the socialism conference one year called the Motherhood Metric, where we would sort of talk about the Tsarist era, revolutionary era, and Stalinist era condition of women, specifically about like contraception, birth control, divorce, you know, the various things that you could see. It's called like bourgeois right. And that, you know, because you could see the advance of freedom, of human freedom, like of human liberation growing from subjectivity and the retreat. And that's the real standard by which we should judge a project. It's not necessarily whether it achieved the thing or not, but, you know, the degrees to which it was capable of advancing. We weren't allowed to do the talk.
So I think it's interesting that in the list of things, and this isn't a call out for the record, but I do think that like the way we're having this conversation is the way it often goes when we're talking about women's liberation, is that we list off all of the things that enable women to have sex without worrying about reproduction, right? Which is important for sure. But what I think Godsey's book does a really good job of doing is talking about childcare. And I think that's not always a thing that we consider, especially, you know, in the reproductive justice movement, is we always talk about abortion. And of course, because that's under attack. But so I understand why, you know, we feel like we need to really focus on, you know, birth control and abortion. But for me, as someone who probably isn't going to get the parasite vacuumed out of me next time, you know, is that too graphic?
Nope, that's definitely staying in.
Yeah, you know, like I'm really bothered by a lot of the antinatalism of the left. And a Marxist and socialist.
You're going to get canceled now.
I'm going to get canceled because
for saying that the left is antinatal. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like everybody knows that children are oppressive.
Yeah, but they don't have to be, right? And I think this book makes a good case for how you know, kids can be less oppressive.
Look, I want to overthrow our child oppressors, but in order.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what happens when you give power to children.
Yeah.
But the point of the conversation, the point of the stuff we've read, right, is that there is a version of society in which, you know, something like the arrival of a child in a person's life could just be nice and none of the other stuff, right?
Instead of like, if we got pregnant right now, it would ruin my whole fucking life. Like everything would just be immediately and. Just worse.
Yeah, I would not be able to manage that very well right now.
Same here.
So, you know.
Yeah.
That's the point of having this utopian horizon, right? And it's funny to be able to locate it in such a pale echo of the society we actually intend to try to bring into existence, right? Like the Eastern Bloc countries, they're really getting a fairer shake in this conversation than they might have in any conversation I've had with any of you at any point up to now over the last decade.
I came, you know, this close. I'm holding my fingers about like a quarter of an inch apart right now, like to becoming a tankie after reading this book.
I know.
And it obviously, that's a joke. It's more like this close.
Full inch.
What I was talking about like earlier with large numbers of orphans and the idea that they didn't have the money for the subsidization of childcare anymore. So they sort of stopped paying for the nurseries and the childcare centers that originally come about the initial phases of like the Bolshevik Revolution, and childcare sort of just loses funding because it's not a priority anymore. Now the priority is defeating the whites and not starving to death, right? Which it's a sad reality, but that's what happened. And Stalin comes along and just formalizes the fact that childcare is now privatized again. You know, why would we pay for childcare when we can get women to do it for free? So the bourgeois family, the bourgeois nuclear family, is sort of shored up under Stalin because Stalin was about the business of primitive accumulation. And Stalin basically... He gets Marx and he gets Engels and goes, okay, let's see, how do you build an
somebody
economy?
Somebody who knows how to economy, please help.
We need some family, we need some private property, and we need a state, and now we got some primitive accumulation. But anyway, you know, essentially, Stalin goes about building the economy that couldn't be built under capitalism because capitalism never developed sufficiently in Russia under the czars. He institutes a massive and brutal period of primitive accumulation. And really, you can look at Stalin's primitive accumulation and the subjugation and oppression of women and homosexuals and the lack of sexual freedom at all, for that matter, as being part and parcel to this project of primitive accumulation.
Right. It has a specific social function. It's not just like
it
bad
does,
dudes
yeah,
doing bad stuff to people.
And we never really talked about it that way previously. I mean, maybe some other more theoretically sophisticated tendencies might have done this, but we never did. It was always just like Stalin was super fucking into just being oppressive. It's just like it annoys me so much when I think about it now that we were never taught to deal with this in a more sophisticated and nuanced way.
Well, it's lazy. It's a convenient argument to be able to say, oh, we're not Stalinists, we're not Maoists, we're not apologists for any of these people. And also, you know, I think something that's really important is that, you know, we're like, well, we're not talking about Scandinavian mm-hmm. versions of, like, social democracy. That's not what we mean. Well, it's like, yeah, but also, like, that's way doper. Let's talk about how much easier it is to be a mom or a parent in a Scandinavian country in those types of models than it is here. So it's like, without saying that that's what we think would be ideal, I don't think we have a good enough way to have conversations, A, about what we actually do mean, and B, about how some of the things that we don't necessarily mean are still cool in some ways and got some things right, even while getting other things wrong. You know, like state-funded paid maternity leave. I don't know. Let's do that.
Yeah, we're going to have a fucking revolution before
we
get that.
No, it's horseshit.
I say this sometimes, and I may have been ridiculed for it lately, even. But it's an indication of a lack of dialectical reasoning. It's an unwillingness to acknowledge that a society is an organic entity under construction or being destroyed, right? So either developing or it's withering. Because, you know, like, you know, it's lazy, yes, but it's lazy for a political purpose, which is that, you know, that society was a bad one. It was constructed as a new class society, and that's not what we want, and that's the end of it. Rather than seeing the whole sphere of Soviet civil society, of Soviet life, as a terrain of struggle, just like any other one, right? Under sometimes much less optimal conditions than maybe in a country like France, you know, like in the 30s, under the Popular Front, it was probably more optimal conditions for worker struggle than the 30s in Russia, whenever, you know, you might go to fucking prison for 5 years for showing up late to work. But on the other hand, you know, if you leave open the possibility that everything's not a done deal by that point, and you see the, you know, the Khrushchev thaw and the sort of revitalization of cultural life, and also the return of a lot of these early Bolshevik kind of legalistic rights re-enshrined in Soviet life, you have to acknowledge, and I think this is politically dangerous for a tendency which defines itself with really specific rules about what has been, you start to see that perhaps Soviet society is still an open question in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s, all the way up until it collapses. You know, Which is to say that maybe a simple categorization of that society as it was this is not very useful.
Yes.
You know, maybe it served
absolutely
its purpose at one point, but certainly not now. And if we can retrain ourselves to think dialectically, right, to think in terms of processes,
right,
of clashes, of new terrain, new contradictions as the old ones get resolved, maybe we can actually like sort of make a new Marxism, a good one, an actual one.
I think that, and this is something we'll definitely have to come back to at in the future, that the way that we were trained to just refer to everything that we didn't like as state capitalism was sloppy, stupid, and dishonest.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
That it took away our ability to be able to conceive of some sort of way to salvage the Eastern Bloc or the Soviet Union. And I think that it's not super important to the conversation.
Way afield. But yeah, no, it was more shorthand for thing that is bad than it was an actual like analytical category, you know? Yeah.
Exactly. And we're going to come back and talk about this in depth at some point in the future, because I really want to try to wrap my head around this without the shackles of my old organization. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to have this conversation.
I really
more
think
fully.
Bureaucratic collectivism is something worth delving into, like analytically.
Well, you know, and I to whatever degree get it, because without the muck of any memories of the Cold War, like Gen Z doesn't give a shit about any of these arguments, you know, like they have no way of conceptualizing this. So people organizing in the midst of the Cold War that have this like instinct to like go on the defense, you know, I get it to whatever degree. I just think we have to leave it behind.
Exactly. I mean,
we're in a completely different era.
Right. And we're in an era where, for all of the flaws of that society, especially if we just look through the lens of this conversation, We could stand to do at least as well as they did. Yeah, for a start,
oh,
right?
For like, fuck's sake,
what
yes.
If, what
sure.
If the horizons of the women's movement in this country, the LGBT movement in this country, were let's do as well as the Czechs and Germans during the Cold War? Obviously, that's
right?
Not a slogan around which you could organize people, right? But that's a conception of what kind of society. Because what would that look like? It would look like state-sponsored seminars. I read this. I thought this was fascinating. The state sponsored conferences on studying the science of the female orgasm, right? And the official reason for it is that you can't have a harmonious society unless people are happy. And
fucking
they can't be
right.
Happy if they're not having sex and good sex.
So I was going to make a quick point. To just sort of like illustrate mm-hmm. things not fitting neatly into categories, and that was the situation of how Czechoslovakia became communist was through a national revolution that threw out the Germans at the end of World War II and made the Communist Party the most popular and powerful organization in the country. And they were able to win election after election after election for several years until they became the most powerful party in parliament and eventually made the full transition to the Eastern Bloc Czechoslovak state that we know of. And not just the Russians came in with tanks and forced everyone to be communist.
Yeah, I mean, that's just literally not how it happened.
It's just absolutely false. And that is the narrative that we're given by, you know, bourgeois historians and the old IST line alike, you know,
and,
the International Socialist Tendency alike.
And
they're both wrong.
And also a lot of the Stalinists too.
So
right.
Almost everybody.
So is that an illustration of the parliamentary road to socialism?
Huh.
Oh.
Damn.
You could add in some kind of like air horns.
I don't think that Czechoslovak state was the ideal state that we would like to reproduce, because obviously there's a little problem that happens in 1968 and
I mean, but it still yeah. serves to illustrate a point that
yeah it does illustrate
it serves
point.
To illustrate a point that if we don't think about the world in terms of processes and the unfolding of contradictions, then what we're left with is a very unworkable linear schematic of like, you have to do this one thing and it never works. Right. I mean, again, this is a whole, so I don't know. I don't want to get into this more. What I want to do is I want us to do, a 2 or 3 part investigation into like the state as a concept. That's what this conversation is illustrating to me we need to do. But when it comes to,
on the list,
when it comes to the horizons of today's movements for liberation, having something to salvage from the past, from the Cold War, for all that we should put behind, right? Like the fact that people's emotional states being a concern of the government, right? That like work-life balance, that not just economic security, but leisure time, and especially leisure time absent the hyper-commodification of life, like it is in this society, without, you know, leisure time in an era of public space and of communal activity, right? That this is a concern of the state, of, you know, Poland and the East German state, or whatever, and all of them, Yugoslavia. That's a horizon that if we had today, we would be far more forward-thinking as a heterogeneous series of movements than we are now. What if it was the concern of the government that you had enough time in your life to enjoy yourself, and there was dedication of state resources to making sure that we could figure out how you enjoyed yourself? That sounds crazy, right? It sounds like, yeah. Well, but you know, that's, so a comrade said this to me, in a completely different context, but I think it's interesting because of the conversation about totalitarianism. Because what I just described is a totalitarian society, right? Where your pleasure is the concern of the state. Sounds pretty fucking totalitarian, right? And I think that you could even imagine a very visceral kind of rejection of that logic by a lot of people on the left. And just, I think it just raises interesting philosophical questions about what we understand the role of the state to be.
Right, exactly. Because so long as you understand the state to be this thing that is doesn't belong to you or people like you, then of course it's going to be a very bad, negative thing. But mm-hmm. if the state is, you know, the way that you and people like you coordinate society, then it seems a lot less scary.
One of the things that really struck me when reading the Godsey book is that East Germany may have been the most progressive state that has ever existed in terms of women's liberation, easily. Like, almost, I think that if you look at the data, there's really no discussion. The amount of resources that were put into educating men about the need to do housework. There were manuals that taught men how to pleasure women better. There was, child care. There was free abortion on demand. There was quotas in government for the amount of women that needed to be represented. There were there was full integration of women into the workforce. This is something that the bourgeois feminism completely just ignores. And that is the idea that women, because this is a feminist issue also, deserve to have the stability in their jobs and the guarantee of jobs and the guarantee that their job is going to provide them with what they need. That of course, is not that none of that is guaranteed in capitalist society, and all of that was guaranteed under this repressive Stalinist regime. So when you look at freedom in East Germany for women, women had more freedom in East Germany than they do in the United States now. They, of course, they couldn't criticize the government, but this is one thing that the tanky, this is a point that the tankies always made, which I think is well taken, is you could criticize your boss in East Germany and in the Soviet Union, and you could file complaints against your boss to the state, and they would come and have arbitration, and they had workers' organizations that would that deal with that sort of thing. So you can complain about your boss, but you couldn't complain about the government. How many of us would trade the the right to complain about the government for the right to complain about your boss?
Say,
right?
I mean,
honestly, I believe that we should have the right to do both.
Wow! But bold stance. That brave.
that brings up the idea of freedom. What is freedom? You know, is freedom the right to starve to death? but also you get to vote for one of two political parties that don't give a shit about you? Or is it the...
Both of which also don't care about your reproductive health.
Also, sure. Yes, that. Or is it what I just illustrated in East Germany?
Well, you know...
The answer is neither.
You know, DeBoer would have said, is this just twin totalitarianisms?
That's overstating it.
I think there's a point to that that's valid, but I think, again, I think it's a lack of appreciation for the complexities of social transformation. Like when the East German workers revolt in 1953, it's a workers' revolt, and it's organized as such, and it follows the model of, well, how we understand revolution. And the same goes for Czechoslovakia in 68, whatever. And so if we only understand these societies as being like relatively freer societies that have made gains, right?
Yeah.
Then how do we understand, how do we get our heads around the rejection of those societies, or at least elements of it, by those populations? And, you know, on the flip side, if you're a defender of the liberal world order, you say, how are there revolutions against countries where you're allowed to buy whatever you want, right? Because the thing is, when people have a taste of freedom, mm-hmm. they seek to extend it, right? And if the purpose of the socialist mm-hmm. project is to, like, emancipate humanity, then this is the problem with Stalinism and of social democracy. And this is one of the things that the IS tradition left us, which I think is right, which is that this idea that, like, nothing's handed to you, you know, and there's no stopping the development of society. You win the gains, you know, you win the right to a job, you win the right to a vacation, right to an abortion, you know, you win the right to protection against discrimination on the basis of whatever, being Jewish or you know, Armenian or whatever. But just like how Sweden can't stop at a robust social safety net, neither could East Germany stop at you're allowed to criticize your boss. You know, that like the development of socialism is the development of human freedom. And if it's marching, then we're building. And if it's not marching, then we're stagnating.
I think that the momentum of the Czechoslovak national revolution against the Nazis and the, you know, building of the socialist coalition government, which led to the communist government of Czechoslovakia, culminates in the project of building a new type of socialism in the 1960s. Which is ultimately crushed by tanks sent in by the Soviet Union from all the other Warsaw Pact countries. And I'm just going to harp on this point for one second again. And that's something that we never really explored fully before, is if there would have been a successful opening up of political freedoms and creating socialism with a human face in the Prague Spring in 1968, would that have been considered to have been true socialism by people who like the IST, you know? Or would that still be state capitalism?
Yeah, I think what's really useful is now being so far removed, right? And especially with younger millennials and Gen Z having no recollection or interest really in the baggage of, you know, the boomers and generations past that is associated with socialism and communism, right? Being able to reflect on, both for us, just like looking at it as history, right? But also for people who have now lived under both, you know, state socialism and capitalism, being able to reflect back on it, all accounts show, you know, is that by and large, people said their lives were better before capitalism. And moreover, women, more so than men, say that their quality of life was better under state socialism, even when it's posed to them as authoritarianism, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, and just to throw out like a few numbers, right? So in Romania, right, only a third reported that their lives were worse off before 1989. 44% said their lives were better, and 16% said there was no change. These results were also gendered in interesting ways, whereas 47% of women thought that state socialism was better for their country, Only 42% of men said the same. Similarly, whereas 36% of men claimed that life was worse before 1989, only 31% of women said life was worse than the present. And then that's reflected in Romania. And then the surveys that are listed in Gatzi's book are from, you know, eight other former socialist nations, you know, for people who have now had, you know, the opportunity for better or worse to live under, you know, both arrangements. So, yeah, I mean, that says something. And I think for younger folks, being able to reflect on that, and if we have the creativity to actually think, like, well, who the fuck is satisfied right now? Like, if we polled people in this country right now about their quality of life, what would people say? You know?
I mean, it's hard to know because like you said, people don't have, what do they compare it to?
I wish that I had thought about this earlier. There was a survey taken of millennials, I think, that like conservatives were throwing this around to illustrate how dumb millennials are, about how this, like, a majority of millennials polled would give up their right to vote for their student loans being
in a heartbeat.
You know,
in a heartbeat.
Forgiven. In a fucking heartbeat. Right? And that just goes to illustrate that, one, we don't give a shit about our votes because we know they don't really matter. And two, that things are so fucking terrible for us now as a result of the debt that we're under that we would give up political freedom for economic freedom.
Right. I mean, people would prefer to live in the East German state than in the United States, whether they understand it in those terms or not.
Do you remember the anecdote where Gatzi said that after giving a talk in an Austrian university, she had a conversation with a Czech woman afterwards? You know, she was an older Czech woman who remembers her life under the Czech communist regime, and she complains about how it wasn't all good. Like, her life was really tough because...
Yeah, no, I remember it. It was really good. She's, like, describing how hectic and difficult life was. But it was, like, how tough it was to, like, rush to catch the train to take the 15-minute ride to the state-provided child care place that her husband would then pick up the child from after he got off of work at, like, 2 in the afternoon. Yeah.
2 o'clock.
Just, like, yeah. All these things. And it was just like, what?
Yeah,
and then
on it.
Yeah, she was like so tired after having worked for 6 hours that, you know, she found it hard to get home by 5 o'clock and make dinner. I was like, holy shit, you're talking about somebody's fucking dream life right now.
I mean, that sounds like if we were to describe that as the ideal future, it would be characterized as hopelessly utopian. People working 6 hours and having state-funded childcare? Well, actually, we'd just be described as communist, and maybe for good reason.
I worked at a pizza place one time whenever I was in my early 20s, and I worked with a Bulgarian guy who was about 10 years older than me. I think he might have been late 30s, early 40s. And when I was I was like 23 or 24, something like that. And I was sort of a orthotrot pseudo tanky kind of orientation at the time, and I wanted to hear what he thought about communist Bulgaria. And so I was like, what do you think about Bulgaria now as compared to Bulgaria when you were a child, you know, and what do your parents think? And he was just like, well, Bulgaria now is a very poor country. We were a very poor country then too, but the difference was that when we were a communist country, we could afford vacations, we always had food, and we never had to worry about whether or not we could pay our bills. It's like, and I was like, so what do you like better? He's like, oh, communism. I'm a communist. Oh. I was like, okay. And he also said stuff like, we always envied the Yugoslavs. And I was like, I always envied the Yugoslavs.
Well, it's like the Eastern European joke in the book, and I'll paraphrase it because it's kind of long. There's like several iterations of it in different languages, right? Which is that, like, it's a woman and she wakes up and she's panicked and her husband asks what's going on. And she's like, I had a dream that we had free medicine and, you know, we all had jobs and food in the refrigerator. And he says, well, what's the nightmare then? And she said that communism is back. And it's like, yeah, wow.
That's funny because
I want that nightmare.
I thought you were going to tell a different Eastern European joke, or it's a Russian joke in particular. He goes like, what has 8 years of capitalism done that 80 years of socialism couldn't do? And the answer is make socialism look good.
Can you put a drinch after
I
that?
I probably can.
You put one after both jokes.
Yeah. Hey everyone, just a reminder that we now have a Patreon. As for now, it's going to stay at $2 and it will just have whatever we feel like throwing up there, and it won't be in any regular fashion. Hopefully we'll be able to become more regular with our exclusive content, and then maybe at that point we will create a second tier with all the really good stuff on it. But for now, there's one tier, it's $2, go ahead and go sign up. Also, like us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and please remember to rate, subscribe, and review us on iTunes so that more people can find us. And as always, please just share our stuff with your friends. And if you've got ideas of things that you would like to hear us talk about, go ahead and send us a private message on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. All right, back to the episode.
In the New York Times review of the Godsey book, there's a quote from one of the subjects, and it's this woman talking about her daughter, who, you know, came of age after the collapse of the Eastern Bloc. And she just says, all she ever does is work. And when I was her age, we had more fun. And it's a really interesting thing to think about. Like, we don't associate these societies as, like, really fun places. Like, you know, we don't think of them as really fun places. We don't think of them as places where, the point isn't to, like, I guess, like, romanticize, you know, freedom or sexuality in these societies. It's just that we have just fallen so far back, you know, like, you know, when Mark Fisher talks about the slow cancellation of the future, this is a really good, this is exemplary of that. Like, we've canceled the future so much that we can't even imagine a society where people just have lots of fun.
Yeah, there was, an anecdote, I think, that Godsey used, where she was talking about a friend of hers who spent a lot of time in the Soviet Union in the 70s, and because there was not an overabundance of things to do, like entertainment-wise, that they were forced to develop incredibly deep relationships with each other, and they sat around in their houses and talked a lot. And they went on walks together, and they hung out in parks together and stuff like that. And that, to me, is...
God, that sounds even so good.
Even still illustrated in the way that Eastern Europeans are now.
Yeah.
Like, Jason, when we were in the Czech Republic, just the idea that everyone's going to stay up and hang out and talk and... just that's what everyone does, and going to bed early, and, you know, just going back to your room, retiring to your room instead of hanging out in the common room and talking to all of the other people was kind of like a weird thing. Why wouldn't you just hang out and talk? So and I'm talking about, like, when we were in Moravia, so it was like the eastern part of the Czech Republic, which is nowhere near as western as, like, Prague and places like that, where it's very much
less fully integrated.
Yeah. And where people just spend time hanging out on the streets and just meeting up in gigantic groups and restaurants. And I mean, it's just, it's better. It's better than what we're doing now. And that's under a society that we don't want to try to construct Stalinism, you know, or soft Stalinism or whatever sure. The fuck you want to call the Eastern Bloc. That's not what we're trying to accomplish, but it is so much better than what we have now, you know, in my opinion.
Well, and, you know, I really do feel fortunate to, in a lot of ways, to have grown up in a city where, you know, a small city in the South where we had to create our own fun, unlike, you know, other places where fun is prepackaged for you and commodified entirely. So, you know, I talk to friends from, you know, like Chicago, LA, New York, and they have no concept of what it is to just like go do a bonfire on the beach with your friends or to steal things with your friends. I mean, to, you know,
or slide down a hill on an ice block. Or,
yeah, literally, they're like, what is ice sliding? And it's like, oh, you know, yeah, just like developing that sort of imagination and being able to, yeah, sit outside or in a room of friends and actually enjoy each other's company instead of having something to do, right?
This is what the situationists called the revolution of everyday life.
I was getting there.
Oh, I stole it. I'm sorry.
I was going to go shout out to the episode on situationism that I didn't get to participate in because I was sick then too.
I think you work too hard, Ginny.
Yeah.
I absolutely do. And so that's the other thing is we don't get to do fun things anymore. So I concentrate all of my fun into like going to Disney and stuff because, I don't have any of it in my regular everyday life because all I do is work. And then when I'm not working, I'm getting my wisdom teeth removed.
I had fun twice in the last 2 years. It was pretty great those two times.
Yeah. Well, the most fun things I've done in every year have had something to do with leaving my regular routines of life and like wandering around somewhere, hanging out, talking about it. Your shout out to the Situationist episode is really right on, right? Because this is what the Situationists called the revolution of everyday life, which is that's like it keeps the horizon open because you're just living in a way which you're very clearly not intended to live, right? Like they close up public space and they take away the avenues for you to construct your own time, to use your own time, and then they hand you something else that like narrows your horizons. So just by virtue of having made fun yourself, at least the theory is that psychologically you're more prepared for being able to imagine a world in which you can do that, you know, that the whole world could be better. Well, so, but I was going to say we're way off the topic of sexual liberation at this point, unless you just think of the obvious connection between enjoying life and sex.
Well, sure. But also just like the way that I'm going to keep talking about kids because I just love them and they're sweeties.
It's a really bizarre segue from what I just said.
I'm getting there. So, you know, part of it too is because of the way we think of things like education and work, right? Those are things that are separate from our lives that are fun, right? We don't think of education as play. And it should be in a lot of ways, right? We think of it as work. We don't think of work as something that's enjoyable. We think of it as drudgery because it fucking is under this system, right? So, you know, I think what you're saying fits right into the conversation that we're having. It encourages us to look at, you know, the shortcomings of state socialism, right? But also, like, have a conversation about what education and work and the things that we look at as work and chores and all of that look like now and be creative enough to like think about what they could look like if we were actually living full whole lives.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think it also marries really well with Colin Tye's picture of what sex should be in a fully liberated society, which is viewed by society in the same way that we look at quenching our thirst and satisfying our hunger. These are pleasures. These are the sort of like, this is the stuff of life, right? Is like making good food and having good company and should also be having good sex, right? These are things that are just, when we clear out the clutter of commodification of capitalism colonizing every corner of our life, then we have actually the space to explore what it really means to be human, and that a significant portion of that is sex, which is what this book particularly looks at, but it's a lot bigger than that.
Yeah, well, because sex for a lot of us has also been a fucking chore, so...
Yeah.
You know, It's literally the same conversation.
Okay, well, so here's what I was thinking then. You know, the liberation of desire, this is the reason why it has to be understood in social terms, in terms of, like, a totality, right? Like, I recently rewatched the Weather Underground documentary after a really long time of not having seen it. And the thing that stuck out the most to me this time, as opposed to the first time I watched it, was the anecdotes about the Smash Monogamy campaign inside it, the Weather faction and SDS, where, you know, you weren't allowed to, you were basically expected to engage in lots of sex with lots of different people because it was part of breaking bourgeois morality. But, like, you talk about sex being a chore. How, imagine being required to have it by your leadership. That sounds worse than capitalism. That sounds worse than what capitalism does to sexual relations.
That sounds exactly like what your husband does to you.
Okay, well, I mean, it sounds like capitalism.
Yeah, it sounds like capitalism, for sure.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. Sex is awesome. I'm just saying, it's so can education and work be, right?
Right.
If it's not, really we're good. Fucking doomed.
One of the things that Gotsy talked about this, like, barely, but since I'm a dude, I thought about it while I was reading this, and she mentions the idea that a lot of men after the fall of communism in the Eastern Bloc liked it better because they didn't have to try as hard with women. They could just, you know, use the fact that they had money to get laid, right? Things like that, you know, the things that...
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, they like, these men were actually saying this. Like, oh yes, it's much better than in a communism where you had to be interesting.
Yeah.
But,
we're smart. We're good at it.
Right. So
glad I don't have to be good at sex anymore now that I have money and it means something.
As a smart, interesting guy that's good at sex but has no money.
Obviously, communism would be better.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking, like, imagine the... think of all of the shitty relationships that your male friends are in, where their wives or girlfriends are with them and they have a very hateful relationship toward one another, but they stay in a relationship together because monetarily it makes sense. You know, economically, they need to stay in the relationship in order to be able to pay for their mortgage or whatever the fuck else, because they have children and they can't afford to support the children if they split up, or they can't afford two apartments. You know, I could go on and on and on.
Couldn't be me.
Right.
Could not be me.
So, well, you know, I mean, my ex and I were in a relationship for way longer than either of us really probably wanted to be. And a lot of that was just because, you know, we needed the economic support of the other person.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Think about how much better our men's lives would be if that wasn't the fucking case, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, like, you know, and it's more than even just the fear of starving to death, right? It's like, because of how terribly alienated we are in this society, and because of the way that we basically latch on to people for fear of being alone or being unable to extract them from our lives peacefully, right? You know, in the way that all of our other relationships are bound up in the we relate to, you know, our friends and people's families and whatever through, you know, our relationships, it's all around like the providing of economic security as like as a basic feature of everyday life is like, you know, that's what I think, you know, this Warsaw Pact states apparently seem to have gotten right. But, you know, another point that Gottsie makes that I think is really important is about, you know, this is essentially, this is a question of alienation, of loneliness, of like human interaction, and that, like, you know, happier people can also separate from each other without ruining each other's lives. Not just in the literal sense, in the material sense, physical sense that we're more immediately afraid of, but also in the ways that we take for granted as being just, this is what happens when people part ways, you know, that they hurt each other.
Yeah.
And that their lives are fundamentally altered because some people don't speak to each other anymore, and thus so some friendships break apart, or, you know, and we witness that all the time, even in what we understand to be healthy relationships.
Right.
I saw Jenny snap whenever I was talking, so that's, I knew I was doing something right.
You done did it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, do we feel comfortable, like, we have a good wrap, or should we, like, try to come up with some closing comments?
I may not orgasm ever again if, like, we don't crush capitalism. We have to dismantle the system, and the likelihood of that you know, I'm just considering celibacy. Ich war allein und die Welt schien leer, so sehr allein unter dem Wolkenmeer.
Ich war allein schon so lange Zeit und jeder Tag war voll Einsamkeit. Ich war allein wie ein verlassener Stern, so sehr allein, denn du warst fern. Ich